From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, top U.S. cardinals and bishops met with Pope Francis in Rome today to talk about the church's sex abuse scandal. But not everyone is convinced change is coming.
We're talking about an organization that cannot even send a reply email to a victim. An entity that can't even answer emails is not going to implement genuine reform.
Also today, companies and CEOs say they're changing the world for the better.
To me, entrepreneurship is about creating change, not just creating companies.
Journalist and writer Anand Giridharadas isn't buying it. And one of Langston Hughes' poems jumps from the page to the stage. That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley was one of a number of U.S. Catholic officials who met with Pope Francis in Rome today to address growing public pressure on the church to deal more proactively with the continuing sexual abuse scandal. U.S. bishops requested the meeting after allegations surfaced against former Archbishop Theodore McCarrick, who was a bishop in New York at the time the allegations occurred. McCarrick has since resigned. The former Vatican ambassador to the U.S., Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, has accused church leadership, including Pope Francis, of being aware of the allegations against McCarrick and also helping him to climb the ranks of the church as well at the same time. The controversy has engulfed Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley, who has had to apologize for the way his office mishandled a 2015 letter from a priest outlining serious concerns about McCarrick. We've got a lot to talk about with news here as well. Joining me now for more on today's meeting is the co-director of bishopaccountability.org, Anne Barrett Doyle. Anne, welcome. So glad you could come in today.
Thank you, Jill.
Also based in Boston. And on the line from New York City is David Gibson, director at the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham University. Good afternoon.
Good to be here. Thanks.
I'm glad you could join us. If I could start with you, David Gibson, some context for today's meeting. The U.S. Cardinals themselves called for this meeting, as we mentioned, with Pope Francis. Any news or policy changes at this point to report?
No, nothing really came out of it. They had a lengthy meeting with Pope Francis and a very anodyne-sounding brief statement saying it was very fruitful and productive, but no details. And in a sense, you didn't, I wouldn't expect them to have a fully elaborated policy response. I think they were really looking, American bishops were really looking for from the Pope is kind of a lifeline, because they have no credibility and they're really up against it. This is a credibility issue of the hierarchy that's been a long time in the making. And what they wanted Pope Francis to do is to actually launch an investigation of them and of the McCarrick issue and of various things, and also start to put in some procedures for holding bishops accountable, which is something that Anne and a lot of us have been calling on for a long time. But so I think he just gave them the green light, and I think a lot of this is under development and under discussion on how this might work.
I wonder if you know if there was much discussion about, we'll go through it again, the allegations by some, including the former ambassador to the U.S., Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, that church officials, including Pope Francis and Cardinal O'Malley, were aware of the allegations against Theodore McCarrick, who, again, was Archbishop of New York at the time. Do you know if that was discussed?
I don't know if that was discussed. I'm sure it was to some degree. I mean, that's something that they have want part of their investigation that they want the Vatican to do is to explain how it happened. And the Vatican also there are a number of steps to this. The Vigano letter was very overwrought kind of political score settling by a very angry Archbishop Vigano, who wanted a red cardinal's hat and didn't get it, so he's settling some scores there. But the crux of it, I think, was his charge that a former Cardinal McCarrick, now Archbishop McCarrick, was able to ascend the ladder of the hierarchy years ago, when everybody, as he said, knew about him sleeping with seminarians, et cetera. So I'm sure that was part of it. The Vatican has said that they will become, the next step, they will be coming out, Rome will be coming out with a statement to answer some of the specific charges that Archbishop Vigano makes.
And while this meeting is going on, or was going on, there are other stories emerging as the bishops meet in Rome. In the last 24 hours, there were reports that Cardinal Daniel DiNardo of the Archdiocese of Galveston-Houston, who led the meeting this morning, is facing his own accusations. There are reports he covered up sexual abuse allegations against a priest, that is, named Manuel La Rosa Lopez in Conroe, Texas, after two people confronted him. Other situations also that today Vatican officials announced the Pope had accepted the resignation of West Virginia Bishop Michael Bransfield, who was accused of sexually harassing adults. So with all of this happening while they're there, that it's amazing, it's remarkable and daunting as to the shifts that are taking place.
They really are. And a lot of these things can get conflated altogether and seem like, one big wave of the same catastrophe. There was the Pennsylvania grand jury report. There was former Cardinal McCarrick, the revelations about him. Now, as you say, today, you've got Cardinal DiNardo in Houston, who's president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference of the American Hierarchy, a report that he did not deal with a credibly accused abuser priest. At the same time, this 75-year-old bishop from West Virginia being investigated for having abused adults. And I think it's important, though, to distinguish among a lot of these things, most specifically these two things today. It's one thing when a bishop like the guy in Bransfield in West Virginia is accused of actually committing sexual abuse against minors or against adults. That can be dealt with. That's a little more black and white. I think, the more serious problem and the one that hasn't been addressed is the one against Cardinal DiNardo, which is what happens to a bishop who violates the bishop's own policies, which is to report immediately and take out of ministry any priest who's been accused. That happens. It's been the standard since 2002, and Cardinal DiNardo did not do that. There's another case in Buffalo now. Bishop Malone accused of the same things. Those, I think, are the more immediate problems because no one is clear on how those are investigated and how a bishop is held accountable.
David Gibson from the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham. Stand by for just a second. Ann Barrett Doyle, co-director of bishopaccountability.org. Let's get you in here. Do you want to first react to today's meeting? There's a lot we've just brought up, but your take on if you know, the significance of today's meeting and what could come from it.
As David said, nothing of the substance of the meeting was reported that we can react to right now. But I'm a little stunned by the news about Bransfield because that seemed to be a reported and settled case. It's just really interesting how old allegations right now are being revived and their credibility is now being recognized where it was formally dismissed. I really agree with David that the allegation that Cardinal DiNardo ignored and dismissed very serious allegations against an active priest in his archdiocese, that is extremely troubling.
I just want to, before we turn to Boston and Cardinal O'Malley, who is really at the center of much of these meetings, he's involved greatly in looking at these accusations and the situation in the church structure. There is another meeting that's been called for by the bishops. This came out yesterday that the Pope is summoning bishops from around the world in February to come to the Vatican to discuss the abuse scandal. That seems a long ways off. And Anne, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, it's 5 months from now. Meanwhile, we can see that children are at risk now, presumably in this Catholic Church, and as are vulnerable adults. Also, the Pope has to take action much sooner. I hope that this isn't another effort by him to deflect responsibility, to outsource responsibility, when in fact he has the ultimate power in the Catholic Church and could do something today to mitigate this crisis.
David Gibson, do you want to weigh in on that upcoming February meeting?
Yeah, I think it'll be an important meeting. I think it's an important sign, and it's also, important that he gets all of these you know, leaders from around the world in the same room. They need to develop more comprehensive policies. Unfortunately, it's not as easy. It's probably easier to do in the United States and in many countries where there's a media watchdog, where there are people like Anne, where there's a legal system, et cetera. There are a lot of places that where actually the church itself is the best guarantor of safety and of justice and of disciplining priests and bishops. So it's going to be a tough thing. You know, in some countries, if you reported a priest or an allegation, they could be thrown in jail for life without a trial or even taken out and killed. So it's a very problematic thing. And I understand it's going to take a while to you know, develop these things. But the fact that he's bringing them all together, it shows a couple of important shifts. One is that accountability for bishops, for the top echelon, the managers, is finally coming into focus. John Paul didn't do much about this crisis at all. Benedict finally sort of took action against abusive priests, increasing laicizations. Now Francis is finally tackling, I think, issues of accountability. But this meeting in February also indicates that it's a global phenomenon. Years ago, as Anne remembers, they tried to dismiss this as an American problem. It's not. America is actually the leading edge of the wave of these revelations.
Right, and Anne, I know you want to. I just want to ask you also to think about this as you want to talk about what's ahead in February. That Germany is now going through its own situation. A study commissioned by the Roman Catholic Church Bishops Conference in Germany revealed that more than 3,600 children, most under the age of 13, were sexually abused by members of the clergy over 70 years. So, as we think about what's coming up in February, how do you advise German Catholics trying to process this kind of news?
What we're seeing, Jill, is that accountability is coming to the Catholic Church, but it's coming from the outside. This has been an unprecedented year. We've never seen so many prosecutors, governments, and investigative journalists hold the church to account as definitively as has happened this year. And as David noted, you know, it is the U.S. has one of the better sex abuse policies in the world. It has the most strict sex abuse policy for the Catholic Church. And so it is so sobering that the president of the Bishops' Conference himself is not implementing a zero-tolerance policy. This does not bode well. I think that the meeting in February will be significant, but only if the bishops emerge with a new set of very tough marching orders.
It was 2002 when this zero-tolerance policy came about, and then a lot has happened since then. Let's talk about Boston's Cardinal O'Malley, who has a role in convening some of these conversations. David, could you explain how deep his responsibility goes? And really, I'd like to hear if you think he's doing his job and go from there.
Well, I think he's in a tough spot. I mean, he's seen as the guy who comes in to clean up a lot of messes, and he's one of the ones who is certainly with a lot of credibility. And that's why he's there today, you know, sitting in the room with Pope Francis and the others. He's on the Pope's commission to protect minors. But in the case of McCarrick, for example, you know, a letter was sent to his office saying that someone had heard about McCarrick sleeping with seminarians. And again, McCarrick is 86 years old. He's long retired. These are allegations that go back 30 years. And one of the secretaries in the office just said this is not something that Cardinal O'Malley deals with. So they just, you know, just responded sort of dismissively. What it points up is again, the lack of any investigative mechanism. There is a mechanism. As soon as Cardinal McCarrick was accused earlier this year of sexually abusing an altar boy, a minor, that immediately kicked in the process. Pope Francis took him out of ministry. His red hat was taken away. He was no longer a cardinal, et cetera. There was no mechanism. There's, you know, now Cardinal O'Malley says he will investigate or he will follow up on any complaint that comes to his office.
And as I understand it, he apologized for how he mishandled the McCarrick.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah, but in a way, the thing is, he can't police the whole Catholic Church. This is just an insufficient mechanism. They need an actual body of lay people, of investigators. So when these things come up, you know, somebody with credibility can do it. Mm-hmm. He's got to run the Archdiocese of Boston.
David Gibson and Barrett Doyle, we have about a minute left. And please weigh in on Cardinal O'Malley. You are in Boston. You are in, you know, in this archdiocese. So is he doing enough? He's got a lot on his plate.
He does. He's not doing enough. He should step aside, I believe, as head of the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. Let someone else try that job. Maybe he doesn't have sharp enough elbows. He says a lot of half-brave things, but he has yet to do something that would really make a difference. He's lost the gutsiest members of that commission. It's time for someone else to run it.
This is a really large question, and I think it deserves a whole lot more treatment. In your eyes, is it possible for the church, the Catholic Church, internationally to recover from what is what we know a decades-old crisis? And
we need decisive action fast, and the Pope could do something dramatic like release the names of all the priests found guilty by the Vatican. That would be a tremendous example for bishops around the world. Mm-hmm.
David Gibson, director at the Center of Religion and Culture at Fordham. Last words on that. I mean, how much work has to be done here and over how many generations?
Well, a lot of work needs to be done. And in a sense, it's a crisis, but it's also an opportunity for Pope Francis, who has said a lot of the right things about the clerical culture that is at the heart of this scandal. It's not about sex. It's about abuse. It's about power. It's not about gay priests. It's about abuse. And it's about clericalism in the church, this caste of priests who are set aside and have an extraordinary power and can exercise it in bad ways. And the Pope wants to reform that. This is actually a chance for him to do that.
All right. I'm sure, unfortunately, we're going to continue to talk about this. David Gibson, director at the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham University in New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Barrett Doyle, co-director of bishopaccountability.org. So glad you could be in here today. We appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. If you are writing the tea or watching YouTube or TED Talk, the advertising out of Silicon Valley and other industries is often tagged with this idea that their products are changing the world for the better. Intel says you can, quote, crush the impossible, and Unilever declares that when you choose Unilever, you help create a bright future, and Facebook's core philosophy is, quote, creating positive social change in the world. Here's how Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg puts it.
To me, entrepreneurship is about creating change, not just creating companies.
Our next guest, the former New York Times correspondent, Anand Giridharadas, isn't buying it. He argues that this philanthropy is only making a difference in ways that allow Mark Zuckerbergs of the world to continue making their huge profits. And then he also makes the argument a step further. He says splashy philanthropic projects coming from the business world are actually distracting us from the kind of structural change that could lead to better wages and job benefits for the 99% is where most of us are referred to. Anand Giridharadas' new book is called Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Anand, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
And very interesting reads. Listeners, we do want to hear from you if you have a chance today. What do you think of this age of big philanthropy and the corporate mottos of changing the world and whether they are legitimate? You're going to hear some more from Anand in a moment about what he calls them. You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send a tweet to @RadioBoston. So, Anand, all these philanthropists who look like these gift horses, you're saying we should be looking these gift horses in the mouth.
I don't think it is a coincidence that we live in the most generous age in American history and the most unequal time in 100 years. There's no question more people are billionaires. There are 184 billionaires around the world have signed the Giving Pledge, giving half or more of their fortunes away. Every young person on an elite college campus says they want to change the world, make the world a better place, start a social enterprise, do something to recycle poop and turn it into coffee or whatever it is that people do these days. You go shopping in the mall, tote bags that change the world, shoes that change the world, you know, red iPhone case that's going to change the world. We're clearly determined, particularly the elites in our age, the winners of this era, to make a difference. And yet I would ask your listeners, has the American dream become more or less real for you over the last generation?
Why is this such a bad thing to better? And I say this provocatively. Why is this such a bad thing? Is it about the balance of wealth, basically?
At first blush, of course, doing good is good. At first blush, trying to help people is good. What I argue in Winners Take All is that the winners of our age are willing, in a time of extreme inequality, to help in any way they can, except by changing the system that keeps them on top and reliably shuts most Americans out of the American dream.
So I want to jump ahead to one of the things that you write about is that if those philanthropists are throwing money to really good things, and we could talk about some news that happened today from Jeff Bezos in a moment, that it is a distraction from perhaps government regulation changing for the better, or as you're pointing out right now, toward they're doing better in their own companies by paying better wages, by paying better benefits. It looks like they're helping out a lot of people. There has been a lot of benefit, a lot of trips and falls too as well, but there has been benefits. So are you saying throw it all out?
No, I am saying that if you are one of the winners of our age, you're running a business or you've made a lot of money in business, instead of asking what new initiative you can do, ask what you're already doing. Are you paying people enough? Are you paying your fair share of taxes? A lot of the largest companies in America don't pay corporate income tax in many years because they employ things called the double Dutch with an Irish sandwich where they ricochet their money around Europe to avoid taxes. I bet none of your regular listeners use a double Dutch with an Irish sandwich to avoid their taxes.
I don't think I've ever heard that.
But big companies do, right.
If
you did, you'd save a lot of money. So one of the things that happens is what the winners of our age do when they do good is that they, in a way, whether unconsciously or consciously, they intercept the public's desire for real change and they substitute a kind of fake change that would be more congenial to them. Women want to be empowered. That's a real desire out there. Well, the kinds of policies that would actually empower women, maternity leave, social policies, health policies, workplace policies to prevent harassment. Well, those are expensive, and they cost the winners something.
Okay.
What the winners want is tell women to lean in, because you know what? That is free. You can just tell women to do that, and a billionaire doesn't have to spend a dime claiming they're on the side of empowering women.
Let's use a case study just from the news, just as you told me as you were walking in the door. Jeff Bezos announced today he's committing $2 billion to help homeless families, and that money is going to go to start preschools for low-income communities. He is the richest person in the world. I believe that is succinct, over $150 billion richer than Bill Gates. He owns the Washington Post. With that as a case study, why is that going to detract from a better situation? Why is that not necessarily a good thing?
Well, I think Bezos has an interesting opportunity because he is perhaps the first major giver to start his giving in a moment when philanthropy is really having a reckoning. I mean, my book is part of a larger conversation that's been happening for a few years about whether this giving is really making change. And Gates and the others started a while ago. But Bezos starts today with this kind of big announcement. And my hope for him, I think in giving money to homelessness and education in Seattle, he's going to help people and he's going to save some families some hardship. But what I hope for them is that he'd go deeper than the palliative symptom treatment approach that is often reflected in these initiatives. And that he'd actually, on those two issues of homelessness and education to start with, ask, what are the root causes? Why are people homeless in Seattle? And when you start asking questions like that, you get to, what do companies pay people? How precariously do they employ people? What is our tax structure so that we can afford affordable housing or not?
And
what are our zoning rules? What are our, why do we tax, why do we fund public schools unequally in America according to your home value instead of your worth as a human being?
And Anna Giridharadas, do we know that those conversations are not happening? For instance, Mark Zuckerberg did something philanthropic in the Newark Public Schools. It was not a complete success, but it was not a complete failure. It was $100 million to the Newark Public Schools several years ago. Some benefits appear to have come out in terms of graduation rates increasing from high school, but there were a lot of errors made along the way. Is there a learning curve at this point for people like Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg to understand how to do better? And have you been hearing those conversations at all?
I think there is absolutely a conversation happening, and the important conversation is the conversation about how do you change things at the root and for everybody through our common institutions and not run your own little pet projects. Mark Zuckerberg, if I'm not mistaken, had not visited Newark when he set out to transform Newark. That is a problem. You cannot give in the way that Christopher Columbus sought to discover the Americas. Okay? You can't Columbus your way into helping people. You have to be part of communities. You have to listen to communities. You have to support organizations that are actually doing this work on the ground for a long time. One of the things that's good about Bezos' approach is he's not talking about creating his own vessels. He's talking about supporting the work that's already out there. I think where he could be a more transformative figure would be if he would have become interested in what does it mean to solve homelessness at the root? What does it mean to solve education at the root for everybody? And how, as someone who is a very large employer in this country, who's made a lot of money employing people, often in ways that leave them having hardships in their lives, how could he be part of reinventing the future of work? How could he be part of strengthening unions and collective bargaining? I mean, something that you may not expect coming from him, but he is rich enough that he can afford to be a traitor to his class.
Yet he may not have any interest in strengthening unions.
Oh, he has zero interest in it.
Right.
And I would call for him to do it anyway. When you are worth as much money as he is, you can afford to do things that you have no interest in.
Okay,
you can afford to do things that would hurt your interest. And that's what I think the next stage of philanthropy is going to be, shifting from merely giving back to actually giving up.
Well, that sounds hopeful in a way, that there's a next stage. And I want to talk about how you came to this moment in time, because you are a journalist. And then you had your own sort of a mid-career professional development opportunity at the Aspen Institute, where you were a fellow, if that's how they're called. And then it became a mid-career wake-up call that you were hanging out with a lot of these very, very wealthy people, or at least sponsored by corporations, that you were finding a rumble in your belly. It did not feel right. So how did this happen?
You know, there's a lot of these kind of benevolent secret societies out there that try to groom people to make a difference, and I was part of this one. And yes, we were all coming together in Aspen, sponsored by, you know, Goldman Sachs and Monsanto and Pepsi and you know, the Koch brothers, to get together and talk about making the world a better place. And at some point, the cognitive dissonance of discussing the betterment of the world and creating projects to better the world while sponsored by and attended by people who are part of the institutions that were causing those very problems we claimed to be solving, the cognitive dissonance grew too much to bear. And I was asked to give a talk there, and I surprised a room full of people there by giving a talk about how we were not the saviors that we were claiming to be, and that the people in the room were perfectly happy to talk about doing more good, but they were never interested in talking about doing less harm. They were perfectly happy to talk about, you know, making a difference, but they didn't want anybody to come for their opportunity to make a killing. They were very happy to, you know, change the world and talk about changing the world, but they didn't want their world to change. And part of what I have been arguing for, and I went on a journey of spending time among the winners of our age who do this kind of work for the last 3 years, and the conclusion of Winners Take All in many ways is that the kinds of change that have actually bettered our world historically often involve sacrifice by the powerful, often involve the powerful having to give up something for the common good to flourish. We didn't get an 8-hour workday. We just look at the field of labor, 8-hour workday and overtime and 5-year-olds not, you know, working in factories sewing shoes anymore and, you know, and safety on the job. We didn't get those things because the winners threw down scraps to workers 100 years ago.
It's a very different economy, though, and I don't even play an economist on the radio. I just know that it's a global economy, and people have never seen this kind of wealth. People like Jeff Bezos never imagined to see this kind of wealth in his own personal lifetime, or Mark Zuckerberg. So it's a different playing field. Also, can you keep going back to another time to the 20th century?
I'm not going back to another time. I'm trying to suggest that at crucial junctures in history, what exists in the economy outstrips the public's capacity to regulate and order it. And those are moments that are ripe for an age of reform. When we had an industrial economy that was burgeoning 100 years ago, we didn't know how to regulate a factory properly. But then we figured it out, and we brought our commons into line with private endeavor. We are ripe for such a moment again. We have invented apps that allow people to, you know, become Uber drivers, and we've invented technology that allows people to rent out their home on Airbnb, and we have created, you know, an Amazon Prime situation where anyone can get things to their door within 2 days. And all of that is awesome that we've built that. But we have not built any of the common institutions to go with that, to make people's lives better, to figure out how social mobility works in this new era where it has stalled, to figure out how you can not only have these great fortunes arising, but actually you can have wages growing because they've stagnated in America. One of the things many of your listeners
This is about jobs. I mean, like, for who is working at Airbnb and who is working at Amazon? You're saying these incredibly wealthy companies that are giving us this social mobility, the people working there?
No, not the people working there. The people not working there are much more of a concern to me. The reality is the bottom half of Americans, about 117 million people, on average, have seen their income go from $16,000 to $16,000. $200 over the last 39 years. Think about that. Think about the amazing things that happened in the last four decades. And all of that future that rained on us, all of it, was most of it was harvested by those at the very top. We live in a society in which the future is being monopolized by a few. That is a different way to think about what inequality means. And what is an extraordinary opportunity for those who truly want to give and truly want to make a difference is not simply to treat symptoms, not simply to palliate, not simply to, you know, have a little change trickle down from the top, but to actually think about what it means to surrender some of their own privilege by fighting for a system that would work better for everyone.
What about the idea that the pie is getting bigger for everybody? And this is from Paul Graham, who founded the tech incubator Y Combinator. He's very successful. I imagine you know who he is in Silicon Valley. He argued a few years ago.
Just because I know who he is doesn't mean I respect him.
I never would imply that. He argued in defense of the tech industry and in defense of that wealth that we shouldn't be so focused on income inequality because people like at Google, like Larry Page, are creating wealth that is making a pie bigger for everybody. I know that you mentioned...
People love to talk about making the pie better, and they often have the drippings of pie running down their mouth, as they say it, in a country where too many people are hungry.
You know what? That's a good point, too. Let's hear from some of these people who want to have something to say about this, because... We are talking about us, I think, in most of us who are out here listening. You can give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Join us on Radio Boston today. Send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We're speaking with Anand Giridharadas. His new book is Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Carol from Sandwich is on the line. Welcome.
Thank you. I do get your guest's point about needing the systemic changes to the economy, but I wanted to bring up just a couple of points from a normal person's point of view, and that is that corporations are just taking the tax benefits, the charitable tax benefits, away from normal citizens because they're offering to, say, donate to some charity if you buy our product. Well, that their charitable contribution there is built into the price of the product. So in our buying that product, money's going to a charity, but we're not deducting that money that we're giving through that corporation. But secondly, I wanted to say that there are young people, say millennials, who are starting up companies, and the companies themselves are doing good. These guys aren't part of the 1%. But the motives for their companies, whether it's, you know, cleaning up the earth or giving shoes to poor people in Africa, I think their hearts are in the right place, maybe because their wallets aren't fat enough yet to get
both, Carol. Both are interesting questions. Thank you for the call.
Thank you, Carol.
So on the deduction issue, the caller raises a very, very important question, which is, I'm not sure all your listeners know that they work longer hours every year and pay higher taxes to subsidize rich people getting a deduction when they give their billions away. And so that's something I think we have to really think about. Why are working class people subsidizing billionaires giving their money away with a massive tax break? It costs about $60, $70 billion a year that we all fund. On the second issue of young people starting these kind of win-win conscious businesses, I think they're often absolutely well-motivated, as the caller says. I think the question is, is there any evidence that they've moved the needle against the pernicious levels of inequality in American life? And I think the evidence is that they haven't.
It may be very well true, Anand, but there is like the individual basis, you know, one-on-one. That our producer has a friend who works at Apple who read Doing Good Better, a book by a philosophy professor at Oxford, William McCaskill, and it made him double down, work harder, get more of his money to charity, feel like he's making the world a better place. What you've laid out here...
Let's take that example. That's such a perfect example.
Okay. Go for it. Why is that a bad thing?
We need to have a more subtle and complicated conversation than we're having. These are not about good and bad. It is a good thing that abets a bad thing, right?
Say it one more time. It's
a good thing that abets a much larger bad thing, okay? So let's talk about the person at Apple who reads William McCaskill's book and says, I can earn to give, which is the phrase that William McCaskill came up with. I can make a lot of money at Apple, and then that'll allow me to donate a bunch of it. That's great. Are you aware of what Apple does to avoid taxes? Are you aware of the scale at which that operates compared to this one employee's taxes? You know what would be better? For Apple to pay its damn taxes the way all of your listeners pay their taxes. Your listeners wouldn't dream of shifting their money around the world the way Apple does to avoid paying taxes. Do you know that if you go to De Anza Community College, right next to Apple, right next to where it is, where many of the employees of Apple send their kids to swim in its pool, do you understand that De Anza has cut its classes and enrollment and funding every year because there's no tax money around there, because Apple is so creative in avoiding taxes? So it is wonderful that one person who makes $100,000 or $300,000 or whatever it is donates some of their money to charity. That person at Apple would be of much greater use to us if they spoke truth to power and said, let's not evade billions of dollars in taxes as one of the world's most valuable companies.
So this gets us to the how, because I realize this is not black and white, but we've got, 7 minutes or 2 minutes left, actually. And you do have people who are living at the individual level. We are not living, I don't have an iPhone, but if I had an iPhone, even if I stopped using it, I don't know that my actions, really impact. So I know you're making a calling here. You're putting out the
call. The call is simple. I don't think not using your iPhone is the call. The call is, the feminists a generation ago taught us, there are no personal solutions at this time. There are only political solutions. And I think we need to actually change where we go to change the world. The next time any of your listeners identifies a problem in their society they don't like, education, health, whatever, think of a solution to that problem that is public, that is democratic, that is universal, and that is institutional. Think of a solution that would solve the problem at the root for everybody, and work in the arena of politics and civic life to make that possible, because it is through movements and from below that we've actually made the changes that truly matter in this country.
All right, let's get a couple of calls in quick, because I think we need to hear from us as individuals. James from Stoughton joins us. Thanks, James, for calling in.
Hey, Anand, I heard you over on the other station earlier today. You're doing a whirlwind tour of the Boston public.
What other station? Don't say it.
I think I completely agree with what you're saying. One point I wanted to make was, in this country, we have a nonprofit sector, a robust nonprofit sector that meets the needs of the gap between what our social safety net provides for people and what people actually need. And we don't have that kind of thing in other advanced societies in the world. And I just want to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And the question is, why do we have a nonprofit sector that caters to many of the needs our safety net doesn't fill? And what you have to understand is that it's a full loop. For the last 30 or 40 years, business interests waged a concerted war on government, in which they pushed for tax cuts and they pushed for government to do less and get out of our lives and reduce welfare and reduce all these things. Then you have all these social problems that are not solved by government anymore. And you have companies that have a lot of money because they reduce their regulatory and taxation burden. And then they come around, the fox having bitten the hen's guardian in the leg comes around to the hens and says, well, I would love to protect you because you have no guardian. The people who fund that nonprofit sector that you talk about, in many cases, are the people who allowed to fester the social problems that now must be tended. And what is much more useful than forcing government to pull back from public life and then coming around to be the savior is to not get in the way of the public tending to its own welfare.
I want to get one more call in here before we have to wrap it up. Lee from Maynard is calling in. Thanks for calling in today. Lee?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yes, thanks for having me on air. My comment is, what I'm hearing resonates deeply with me. I'm an investment fraud claims attorney. The notion of speaking truth to power is something I've come to see as necessary after about 15 years, including as an arbitrator in the financial industry. But as a claims advocate now, previously been defense side, but claims advocate, I have been able to see instances that are shocking. And the retention of wealth, it does come down to a greed issue, but I have some basic issues that we should be challenging as well. The technology issue, we do have the means to do far better. It's a greed and will issue. But, in other matters like healthcare, why do we care about the life only until the life is pushed out of the womb? Why not invest in the next generation? Healthcare. I'm talking socialism. I don't care. It's not a bad word. We got to think of something else that takes care of all these people, given our resources.
Anand, if you could jump in here, we have less than a minute left. Thank you, Lee, so much for calling in.
I think whether it's, you know, the caller may be drawn to socialism now. I think you have this nationalism on the right that's raising questions about trade. This doesn't feel like a great moment in American life to many people. I think, actually, I want to make the case for this being a very creative moment in American life. I actually think we have a consensus among 60, 70, 80% of Americans that the American dream doesn't feel real to them anymore, that the society feels rigged against them, and that all of the conventional answers to how to make this country better ring hollow. And I think that's why you have movements that were unthinkable 10 years ago on both sides. And I think there's a chance that after the Trump era, there will actually be not just another president, but a new age of reform to solve some of these issues at the root for everybody.
I think there are some very smart and very wealthy people in Silicon Valley who, if you get to them, Anand, there could be a conversation or a debate about what's going on.
I'm having it.
All right. That's Anand Giridharadas. His new book is Winners Take All, the Elite Charade of Changing the World. And you can hear more of him tonight. He'll be discussing the book tonight at 6 at the Brattle Theater. He'll be back for the Boston Book Festival October 13th. Christopher Lydon will be talking to you then. Anand, thanks so much for joining Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. A poem is on stage at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge. It's Langston Hughes's The Black Clown, written in 1931. Hughes, who died in the 1960s, had originally published the piece with director notes for an inevitable performance. Baritone Devon Tynes and composer Michael Schachter adapted the poem into this production. Devon is The Black Clown.
I'm poor and black and funny, not the same as you. Oh no, not the same as you.
Those are the opening lines of the poem. Those are the opening lines of this performance piece that said over and over to music, dance, more singing. It's an incredible performance. Joining us in the studio to talk about the work of Langston Hughes in this particular work is Jabari Asim, who is a poet and professor of creative writing at Emerson College. It's really nice to see you again.
Thanks, Jill.
There is more coming from you as well, also the co-writer of the forthcoming musical Brother Nat about the 1831 Nat Turner Slave Rebellion. I hope we get to talk to you about that when that comes out. As someone who knows Langston Hughes's work, what was your reaction to seeing this performance, music theater piece, as it's called, at the ART?
Well, I had a couple of thoughts. I mean, one, I was really surprised and I have to say impressed that they chose this particular piece to adapt. I mean, when you think of Langston Hughes in stage, you think Tambourines to Glory, you think Black Nativity, you might think Mule Bone, his collaboration with Zora Neale Hurston, but it's highly unlikely that you would think of The Black Clown. So I thought that was a surprising choice.
As far as you know, did those pieces have directorial notes? Like, I'm looking at the Black Clown printout from the playbill, and right alongside the poem are a series of notes that you would see, like stage entrances almost, and type of music and mood to set. Do those other pieces, did Langston Hughes also do that with his work?
Yes, yeah, he did do stage directions. I mean, and we can talk more about that, because these stage directions are pretty minimal, you know? I mean, mainly they suggest that he's thinking about the poem as a recited work, but the directions are pretty sparse.
We're not going to have time, probably, to give our listeners the entire poem. Are you able to say what it is about in its many stanzas?
Well, he sort of traces the evolution of the black image in popular culture, while at the same time including elements of the history, enslavement, et cetera. But also, I think he's alluding to the tradition of blackface minstrelsy, the idea that entertainment was one of the few areas of entry for African Americans after emancipation. So in some ways it was freeing, but in other ways it was very limiting, because the larger culture wanted to see black people primarily as comic characters.
And I, having just seen this piece last night, can can see that. It was a very stark, a bare stage, a beautiful dancing, incredible singing, not as general entertainment. I knew this when I was watching this. I felt strange to applaud even during the performance because it felt like a piece, and for other reasons too, because of the tone of it. But these director notes that Langston Hughes did provide through this poem and others, you know, he wanted people to follow those notes closely, I imagine. I want to hear from Devon Tynes, the baritone who you just heard sing, talking about what it was like for him and for Michael Schachter, the composer, to come across this poem and why they made it into a production.
Mm-hmm. He was very direct about proclaiming a message of self-realization, of freedom, of transcending oppression that had not been so clearly outlaid in other parts of his work. So it was just exciting to find that thing, but then also be daunted by the task of what do we maybe do with this?
You know, in the poem, there is this part about the clown experiencing joy. I'm not sure if you and I had the same piece lined up here. Would you mind reading this and then passing that back to me?
Sure.
It's right there.
Only in song and laughter, I rise again, a black clown. Strike up the music, let it be gay. Only in joy can a clown have his day.
In this notion of here I am, back here, striking up the music, there was a scene, for instance, early on in the first, this is a 70-minute performance, early on, let's say 10 to 15 minutes in, that's three or four stanzas down, where it is just a beautiful scene of singing, of dance. You have mixed in not just the stanzas from this poem put to music, but you have some incredible singing like songs, Strike Up the Music. You have songs, Black in a White World, Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. These are at different scenes. It was a beautiful thing to see well-heeled scene of black Americans having a great time. And then it changed abruptly. Can you talk about that and what you remember seeing?
I thought there was a remarkable tension in those scenes. The night I saw it, there was very enthusiastic applause during moments of great somber moments on the stage. And I had to remind myself, these people are applauding the vocal performances, the outstanding performances that we're seeing on the stage. They're not necessarily applauding the history that is being portrayed. So there is that tension.
I was in there as a journalist, not as a theater goer. And I was sitting there also thinking, I'm not and there was a standing ovation in the middle of the show, not even at the end of the show where there was another one. It was a different experience. It was also a very white audience.
They're,
yes. Largely, but I'd say, you know, I'd say 85 to 90% white, which is not uncommon for theater audiences or for the American Repertory Theater.
Right.
I feel safe saying that. Let's hear a little bit more of this performance. And this is this Strike Up the Music scene with a 12-member ensemble. I wonder what you think Langston Hughes would make of this, which is a crazy question. But I'm
well, no, you know, here. I mean, I think we have to say that this is a minor work by Langston Hughes in his body of work. You know, this is if we go to his top 10 poems, for example, this one's not going to appear. And I think one of the remarkable things about the production is that it actually improves upon the poem. because I think it worked out better on the stage than it works out on the page. And I think that credit has to go to the creative team that put it together because they're going way beyond the director's notes that Langston Hughes has here. And I think that's a pretty impressive act of imagination to conceive of that and then to execute it.
Isn't that, though, in some way, what happens with poetry in general? When you write something, Jabari, it's out there for us to interpret.
Yes.
If I read The Black Clown to myself, I would never have even found halfway, you know, the energy or the insight even to how it was performed. What do you find in the value of this work, though, jumping from the page to the stage? Not just this poem, but if there was another Langston Hughes poem, why not? You know, if there were other directions. Does that take away from the work's intent, from its original intent?
I don't think so. And I think if we were to risk considering what Langston Hughes might think about it, I think that he was a poet who was very concerned about audience and bringing his work to the widest possible audience. And the value of a production like this, especially one that's done as well as this, is that it's going to introduce Hughes to multitudes of new audience members who may not have encountered him before, may not have been familiar with him, and now will actually turn to the text as well.
What would you like to see put to stage of his work?
Oh, man. I mean, his complete works are 18 volumes. So I would like to spend some time just doing some deep catalog diving before even speculating.
Well, this has certainly given us an excuse to do that maybe with you. And we look forward to hearing your next piece as well. So thanks for coming in today. Jabari Asim is a poet and professor of creative writing at Emerson College, also the co-writer of the forthcoming musical called Brother Nat about the 1831 Nat Turner slave rebellion, set to hit the stage not long from now, Paramount Theater, October 25th. Again, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.